So please turn back to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. And last time we had gone as far as verse 6. We're going to pick it up there this morning. Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Many of you will recognize the name Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He was a Russian author of history and fiction, who during the days of the communist Soviet Empire, he spent decades in prison, in labor camps, eventually exile, and he even survived an assassination attempt by the KGB. And the reason that he went through all those experiences was precisely because of his criticism, his very outspoken and very detailed criticism of the Soviet regime. He was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize for Literature in 1970, but his most famous work came out in 1973, The Gulag Archipelago. And a lot of what he wrote there and in other places had to do with exposing the sorts of things that went on in the Soviet prison systems, the oppression, the abuse, and writing out of his own horrific life experiences. Here is one of the comments that he made. Bless you, prison. Bless you for being in my life. Would you have thought to say that about years suffering in a Soviet prison? He said, bless you, prison. Why? For there, lying upon the rotting prison straw, I came to realize that the object of life is not prosperity, as we are made to believe, but the maturity of the human soul. The maturity of the human soul is what he came to see as the object of life in those conditions. And that sounds a lot like the Bible. And it sounds a lot like our text today, which is Ecclesiastes chapter 7, from verse 7 to verse 14. And you will remember that there is a close connection between this chapter and the end of chapter 6, which had ended with a question about what is good for man, or who knows what is good. Given all the factors of life in this fallen world, what would be the good, the best way to navigate life? The question is not answered because the question is no human being actually knows what to do under these circumstances. But the implied answer is that God is the one who knows, and therefore we ought to seek him for direction. And in chapter 7, he gives some of that direction. You might remember that there are a lot of usages of the Hebrew word tov, which means good, translated in different ways like better. It shows up a number of times in chapter 7. And last week, we saw a couple of those good things that the Lord is encouraging us about, to think of them in a good light, to value them, to take them in, to appreciate them, to learn from them. And our theme in verses 1 to 6 was that hard things can be good things. And the two hard things that are good dealt with in those verses were, first of all, exposure to death and being confronted with that reality at a funeral, and as well, the idea of receiving rebuke is a hard thing, but it is a good thing. As we move on here in chapter 7, the passage is going to continue using that good terminology. It doesn't always appear on the surface in our English translations, but it still occurs there a number of times. But actually, with the good idea in mind, the text is going in a little bit different direction. See if you can pick it up as I read, starting at verse 7. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning. And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of money is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. And we see there a list of proverbs that make a variety of points, and yet in one way or another, they all relate to the idea of good that this passage has been stressing. And as well, in one way or another, I think you would have seen this, they all relate to suffering. They all relate to hard experiences of life. We saw words like oppression. We saw words of questioning one's circumstances. We saw the idea of crooked and adversity in our circumstances. So here Solomon is talking about good things, but in connection with these very painful things. I hope you'll see this morning as we look at this passage that really what we're getting here is good counsel for hard times. Last week we saw that hard things can be good things. This week we're getting some good counsel as we experience hard times in life. In fact, we're going to see here six pieces of counsel, six pieces of advice. And it's the last one especially that's going to give us the bottom line, the instruction that we are being given here about working through those hard times. And look at verse 7. Here's where we find the first bit of counsel. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. That is not an imperative. That is an observation of life. And yet in the context, which has to do with navigating through difficulty, making wise decisions through difficulty, the implication as you connect it with the rest of what is said is this. Here's the counsel by way of a warning. In hard times, stay true to your principles. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. In hard times, here's what we need to do. Stay true to our principles. You know, Ecclesiastes makes a number of comments about the abuse of power and how those who are in authority often oppress those who are underneath them. You might remember one of the things back in chapter 5, I'm quoting here from the NET Bible in verses 8 to 9, it says, if you see the extortion of the poor or the perversion of justice and fairness in the government, do not be astonished by the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher official, and there are higher ones over them. The produce of the land is seized by all of them, even the king is served by the fields. In other words, you can pretty much expect that when it comes to fallen human beings who are in positions of authority, the tendency, the characteristic is going to be that they will take advantage, that they will extort the poor, and even all these levels of bureaucracy that are supposed to maybe provide for some protection, often the whole system is corrupt the higher up you go. And now keep that in mind as you come to this statement that surely oppression drives the wise into madness and a bribe corrupts the heart. His point is that under the kinds of circumstances that I described there, even the wisest of people are tempted to compromise their beliefs in order to get some relief from the oppression or in order somehow to get ahead under those difficult circumstances. They can do foolish things that under ordinary circumstances they would totally repudiate. One of the things that they might do is, as it says in the second half of the verse, to take a bribe. Proverbs 17:23 says, "The wicked accepts a bribe in secret to pervert the ways of justice." We expect that from wicked people. But what this verse is saying is that sometimes even generally wise and righteous people need to guard their hearts, because they may end up under the right provocation doing the same sort of thing when they are under duress, when they are feeling pressure. They may as well cave. And have we not been frustrated multiple times by, up to that point, seemingly good politicians? It's discovered eventually give in to that pressure. And yet I don't think we want to limit this to politicians. They are easy targets when it comes to this point. We want to recognize that all of us are susceptible to this temptation as well. In fact, as our culture becomes increasingly secularized, you and I, if we are committed to a biblical worldview, we will face more and more of these temptations. We're going to face tension and conflict over what we believe. And the temptation will be to give up on biblical truth in order to protect ourselves or in order to gain some kind of advantage. And that would be contrary to God's definition of what is good that this passage is discussing. In hard times, we are encouraged here not to give in like that, but to stay true to a wise, a biblical path. It doesn't mean we can never reconsider any of our positions. It doesn't mean we cannot shift our approach depending on the circumstances. But it does mean that there is a subtle temptation to make adjustments. And normally this doesn't happen overnight. Normally it's a slow process of our giving in to pressure that ultimately ends up undermining the very foundations of our faith. And so we're being challenged here in hard times, stay true to your principles. But also, look at verse 8. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. We are being counseled there in hard times, wait patiently. When in verse 8 it says, better is the end of a thing than its beginning, we might remember that back in verse 1 he had talked about the day of one's death being better than the day of one's birth. We talked about that last time and how that is the case. But what was said there generally about life is now being applied to specific circumstances, specific events, including trials. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning. In fact, one reason that we are tempted to compromise is that we are too focused on the outset or the in-between and the struggle along the way and not focused enough on the end, not oriented enough toward the goal. This verse is urging us to develop, to nurture a long-term perspective, focusing on the end, the goal of the hard times that come into our lives. In hard times, wait patiently. Now, this book is not going to develop right here what is the goal that God has in mind often in those hard times, but we have the rest of the Bible to fill out that question. What it is that we are waiting patiently for. And like what Solzhenitsyn said, here is one of the goals. This is from Romans chapter 5. Suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not put us to shame, because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. What is the goal according to that passage? Well, the goal of hard times, at least partially, is that it is a process that God brings into our lives that begins to work on us personally. And it works in us endurance, and that in turn strengthens our character. And as we experience more of the sanctifying, transforming of our character, when God works in us in those hard times, our hope is deepened. That's the process here. Endurance, character, hope. What's the point? What's the connection with the hope? The connection is that the more I see God doing in me these supernatural things, enabling me to persevere, growing me in my faith, growing me in my character, I am more and more assured that I'm actually one of his children. My assurance is deepened. I have a stronger degree of hope that I'm going to enter into the fullness of his blessing and working in eternity. And then it throws in this thought that the love of God has been poured out in my heart through the Holy Spirit. That is what is actually making all of this happen, is the work of the Spirit and the love of God and his assuring me that I'm one of his children. It is at work in me through suffering in a way that really nothing else can do. And so there's one of the goals that Ecclesiastes would point us to. The transforming of our character and the greater degrees of assurance and the greater experiences of the love of God. I found this prayer from a Confederate soldier along these lines. He said, "I asked for strength that I might achieve. I was made weak that I might learn humbly to obey. I asked for health that I might do greater things. I was given infirmity that I might do better things. I asked for riches that I might be happy. I was given poverty that I might be wise. I asked for power that I might have the praise of men. I was given weakness that I might feel the need of God. I asked for all things that I might enjoy life. I was given life that I might enjoy all things." There's a paradox there that sounds a lot like Ecclesiastes. "I got nothing that I had asked for." You ever feel that way? "I got nothing that I had asked for, but everything that I had hoped for. Almost despite myself, my unspoken prayers were answered. I am among all men most richly blessed." Not because he had an easy life, but because of all of these sufferings heaped up one on top of another, he experienced the kind of transformation that Romans 5 was talking about. And reflecting that sort of thinking, this passage in Ecclesiastes is urging us to nurture patience in hard times. And what's interesting, if you look back at verse 8, it says, "And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit." Maybe that's not how we might have set up the contrast. We might have said the patient in spirit is better than the hasty in spirit or something like that, the person who's in a hurry, who can't wait. But he actually says the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. The opposite here of patience is actually pride. How is that so? Well, when we get frustrated with God's timing and we are all anxious and restless about it, or when we somehow shortcut the process and just try to get out of the trial as soon as we can, and in whatever self-reliance way we can, some illegitimate way to stop the suffering, in all of those kinds of responses, at the end of the day, what are we doing? We are acting as though we are God and as though we have the prerogative to determine these things, right? So that our impatience is actually a form of pride, because I'm not satisfied with how God's working and when he is working. And so I think I have a better way. I am relying on myself. Impatience is a form of pride. So the other way of saying that is that to wait on his timing is actually an exercise in humility. In hard times, wait patiently. And that word of counsel is going to be amplified as we go on to verse 9 for our third piece of advice. Verse 9 says, "Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools." Clearly, he's talking about anger there as we go through challenging and painful experiences. And he tells us, in hard times, resist anger. One of the ways that you and I show our impatience with the Lord is by ranting when we're in pain. It is by lashing out in anger, whether at other people who are somehow connected with our circumstances or directly at God himself. And this verse teaches that that kind of response, that anger is foolish. It is the mark of a fool to be responding in that way. Why? How is that foolish? Well, for one, anger doesn't accomplish anything productive. It doesn't change the circumstances. It is not a positive way to try to resolve whatever is in front of us. It is just an emotional knee-jerk reaction that really doesn't do anything. It doesn't change the situation for the better. It just shows that in that moment, you and I are giving in to the influence of the flesh, and it also creates a lot of hurt to those who are exposed to it. It's foolish. And maybe James had this verse in mind when he said this: let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. In hard times, resist anger. But actually, Solomon says it a little more strongly than just anger is foolish. Look at the statement again. It says, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. That's a more specific statement than if he had just said, this is foolish. It lodges in the heart, or literally the bosom of fools. The idea is that anger settles in there. It takes up a kind of residence in the heart of the person. It comes to permeate your general outlook on life. It damages you personally when you do that. We tend to call that experience of anger bitterness. We think about something just continually seething up in our hearts and just nurturing this sense of hurt and this reaction against somebody who has hurt us. Maybe you've heard it said that bitterness is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. Making the statement that really you're just damaging yourself in all of this. And one theologian, he kind of expanded on that thought when he said this: of the seven deadly sins, anger is possibly the most fun. To lick your wounds, to smack your lips over grievances long past, to roll over your tongue the prospect of bitter confrontations still to come, to savor to the last toothsome morsel both the pain you are given and the pain you are giving back, in many ways it is a feast fit for a king. The chief drawback is that what you are wolfing down is yourself. The skeleton at the feast is you. And so if we're asking what is good in life and how do I deal with hard times, one of the answers that comes back is don't give in to bitterness and anger. And a little bit more specific word of counsel, our fourth thought here in verse 10. In hard times, don't dwell on the past. In hard times, don't dwell on the past. Solomon writes, say not. Here's an actual imperative, okay? He says, say not. Why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. When faced with hard times, our tendency often is to look back wistfully at the past, to long for earlier times that in our minds were a whole lot better than what we're experiencing right now. And that very easily, what it does is to lead to complaining about the present. If you're overly focused on whatever good you experienced in the past, and that's kind of the main category in your thinking, it is going to lead to a lot of discontentment and frustration about what you've got going on right now. And once again, Solomon says you're giving in to folly when you do this. He says it is not from wisdom that you ask why the past was better than the present. And here again, I think we ought to ask, well, why is it not from wisdom? What is so foolish about it? Well, I think as a starting point, one reason is that the past was probably not as ideal as you think it was. And somebody said, the good old days are the combination of a bad memory and a good imagination. We are thankful for good things in the past, but very often we are blinded to realities even in the past that were problematic. And I can hardly think of an area where that's more relevant than to think on the broad scheme of our nation. And clearly, as we look around and as we go through this political season, we're all very frustrated and very let down and very grieved about the moral decline in this country. And we ought to be. And over time, sin does degenerate a culture more and more. But I would say, on the other hand, that we are not helping our cause by painting the past with such a rosy picture, when that really is not a realistic perspective of even this country. Do you realize every country is a mixed bag in terms of its traditions and in terms of its history? And even though today we're very concerned about issues of abortion and marriage and so forth, and rightly burdened about that, who was burdened about slavery 100 years ago? Who saw that as the moral evil that it was? In some ways, the past was better, but in some ways, it was really not. And Solomon is warning us about this skewed viewpoint and this over-focus on the past. But another reason for saying that that sort of thing is not from wisdom is, like with anger, that dwelling on the past often does little or nothing to actually change the present. It just gets you all worked up. It just increases your frustration. It doesn't really improve the situation. And that isn't denying that we can learn good lessons from the past or that we shouldn't try to implement those lessons in the present. But here is what it is saying. First of all, that human beings as we are, limited as we are, we just cannot bring back the past. That is impossible to us. It's also suggesting here that every new circumstance and every new era has its own peculiarities that are going to require a fresh analysis and a fresh approach, a fresh consideration to how to work out the principles of Scripture. And then there's this: there may be difficult circumstances in the present, really, that we can't change at all. And at a certain point, talking about the good old days is only going to end up making matters worse for us. Fundamentally, what we need is not the memory of the past, but we need wisdom for the present. And that's actually the next thought here as we come to verses 11 to 12. In hard times, here's what you and I need to do. We need to seek wisdom. What have we seen? What is this advice? In hard times, stay true to your principles, wait patiently, resist anger, don't dwell on the past, and number 5, seek wisdom. It says in verse 11, wisdom is good with an inheritance, which probably would better be translated, wisdom, like an inheritance, is a good thing. In other words, there's a comparison there, and we'll see that as we go on here. Wisdom, like an inheritance, is a good thing. That's the net translation again. An advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. What you have going on there is a comparison between wisdom and wealth. And this is something we can all understand. Everybody, I think, understands the relative value of material wealth. In general, an inheritance is a helpful thing. It is a good thing in that it provides for the long-term needs of your descendants. In general, money provides protection from many of the threats and problems of life. In fact, the word protection there in verse 12 is literally shade. It gives you a shade, and it's used, for example, of a roof over your house. Money does literally put a roof over your head. It gives you a great deal of material, immediate, temporal, physical protection. And if you understand those kinds of basic benefits of money to provide for our needs, to protect us from disaster, we will as well understand the benefit of wisdom. Because wisdom does the same kinds of things for us that money does. Now again, take this in context. This isn't a whole statement about money. This isn't a total statement even about wisdom. Let's be focused on what is being said in this passage. The fact is, Ecclesiastes has said a lot about wisdom, and it has shown us that even wisdom has its limitations. You remember perhaps that concept. Wisdom cannot solve every problem. Wisdom cannot prevent every problem. Wisdom cannot answer all your questions, and wisdom is not going to stop certain things from happening in your life, chiefly your own death. For as wise as you are, you're going to die. So there are these limitations, but nevertheless, if we are interested in navigating our way through life in a fallen world, and especially if we want to know how to respond to hard times, to suffering, we desperately need this thing called wisdom. It is the skill that will help us make the best possible use of earthly life to find as much protection as is possible, to figure out the best conceivable way to respond to the hard times. That is the statement here. In hard times, wisdom may not answer every question you have, but it's really the only solution out there that will help you seek wisdom. And that leads to the question, well, how do we go about doing this? Where do I get this wisdom? And we're going to see this develop. We're going to see this unfold as we go through this book some more. But let me just answer very briefly how we would go about getting this wisdom. You would have to start with what Solomon wrote in the book of Proverbs, that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So that if you're interested in how do I make skillful use of life and respond to these issues and problems, you better be sure you're right with God. You better be sure that you have humbled yourself, you have recognized your need, you have recognized your sinfulness, you have cast yourself on the Lord for reconciliation and forgiveness, that you are nurturing a spirit of reliance upon Him, walking in the fear of Him, responding to what you know about Him, seeking to maintain an awareness of Him and His holiness throughout life. That's how you would start to develop this. The fear of the Lord is the beginning, the starting point, the foundation of wisdom. And to continue on that, we listen to what God Himself has said about wisdom in the Bible. And again, we have great help in the book of Proverbs. You want to remember the many times, especially at the beginning of Proverbs, where as the father talks to the son, he just keeps saying, listen to me. Give me your ear. Don't let this moment pass by without really letting this register in your consciousness. I'm not making this up. This is divine revelation in the case of Proverbs. And in the case of Proverbs as well, it is divine revelation that this father has learned in and through the experiences of life. And it's like he has to spend 8 or 9 chapters before he gets into very much of that, pretty much just saying to the child, listen, okay? Open your ears. And don't we all need to hear that? Are we actually paying attention to the instruction that God is giving us through His word? That would have to be a part of gaining wisdom. And then we're instructed as well in Scripture, if we want wisdom, we ought to pray for it. Right, James 1:5 says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. And how many times, maybe even this week, you have found yourself on your face before God saying, I don't know what to do. I was refreshed to hear Pastor Greg Baker share that same thought last week as he was talking about some of the circumstances he's going through and counseling that he does, and how often he's just like taking all this in and just clueless. What do I do, Lord? Well, that ignorance, that sense of need is what drives you to the kind of heartfelt prayer that James 1 is talking about. And then as the core of all of this and as the means of all of this, we see Christ specifically, who is described in Colossians chapter 2 and verse 3. It says that in Him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. So we nurture the fear of God by seeking Christ specifically, by listening to his revelation, by earnestly praying. That would be part of the biblical explanation for how you actually do verses 11 to 12 in hard times, seek wisdom. And as we do those things, and as we are exposed more and more to Scripture, we're going to be taught again and again the theme that our text ends with in verses 13 to 14. And it is this: in hard times, bow before providence. In hard times, bow before providence. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. There is the ultimate perspective on hard times. It is to ask, how does God fit into this? Consider the work of God. Look carefully at what he has done and is doing, and consider especially the truth that everything that happens in your life is under his government. It is under his rule. It is the product of his sovereign authority. And it says that he makes some things straight and some things crooked in verse 13. We want to clarify that those are not moral categories there. It's not talking about God making some people sinful and others not. We're talking in this whole context about our circumstances. That which is straight refers to that which is smooth and easy and enjoyable. That which is crooked refers to what is rough and hard and painful and hard to bear because it's not what we expected. Straight and crooked in those terms, which is what verse 14 says, right? It describes the same idea in terms of prosperity and adversity. That's what we're talking about, prosperity and adversity. The first line of verse 14 literally says, in the day of good, be in good. It's picking up on this good idea. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. Enjoy the good times. Not only is it not wrong to do that, you would be a fool not to do that. And this harkens back to this emphasis in Ecclesiastes of enjoying the legitimate pleasures of life that God has given you. And we don't want to lose sight of that with all this talk about suffering. Suffering is not all there is to life. And again, if we would just look, open our eyes, consider the work of God, we would realize that we have a lot more to be grateful for than we recognize. Consider the work of God. You have had many days of prosperity. You have had many reasons for happiness and joy. That came from God just as much as the other. Take it in. Receive it as his love for you. And nevertheless, the passage does speak of adversity, and it's real. It's real because providentially our individual lives are all touched in some way and in many ways by the curse that resulted from sin. It says God has made the one as well as the other. Or more literally again, he has made the one over against the other or corresponding to the other. It's a straightforward declaration that every one of us can expect our lives to be a thorough mix of good things and bad things, of enjoyable experiences and rough experiences, of crooked things as well as straight things. And how do you deal with that when God is the one who is programming all of this in? And even though you can take medicine to make you feel better, and there are some things you can do to sort of get out from under the pressure of adversity, there are going to be some things that just are totally impossible to remove. You can't change some of these. So what do you do? Well, the passage ends by saying that because your circumstances are so mixed and you don't know what the exact combination or pattern is going to be, you cannot tell what is going to come next. You cannot predict the future. That seems to be the thrust of that man may not find out anything that will be after him. You don't know which is going to be next, prosperity or adversity. You have no way to predict that or to guarantee that. And so the effect is to throw you back on God, to humble you, to put you in a position of trust and utter dependence on him. Remember, I've talked about radical dependence on God. That's what we're looking at here. And this is central to the kind of relationship to God that Ecclesiastes has been talking about. Somebody said, we don't know what the future holds. We simply have to trust our God who holds the future. And that attitude of trust is so much for our eternal good that in God's mind, even the hard things are worth it if they are pushing us in that direction. And this passage is urging us to take God's viewpoint, that this spirit of dependence instead of pride is so important to our eternal joy that it is worth the suffering if it's going to push us more and more in that direction. There is a famous book that is an exposition of Ecclesiastes 7:13, and it's called The Crook in the Lot, by the 18th century Scottish preacher Thomas Boston. You see in this printing, very appropriate, they've put a picture of the old Twin Towers. And here is the subtitle, The Sovereignty and Wisdom of God Displayed in the Afflictions of Men. The crook in the lot, right? The lot idea, everybody has a portion from God, and some of the things in the portion are going to be crooked. They're kind of bent. They're kind of twisted. Not everything is straight and smooth. And he goes on for 150 pages meditating on that truth. Let me just share with you some thoughts here in closing. He says, there is a certain train or course of events by the providence of God falling to every one of us during our life in this world. And that is our lot as being allotted to us by the sovereign God, our creator and governor. This train of events is widely different to different persons according to the will and pleasure of the sovereign manager who orders men's conditions in the world in a great variety, some moving in a higher and some in a lower sphere. All right, there's a reason why I think it was Spurgeon who said that the sovereignty of God is the most offensive doctrine for human nature. Because you look at one person's life and you look at another person's life and one has so much more bent stuff and you're like, why? They're not any worse than this guy. Why? And the answer is the good pleasure of God. The crook in the lot for that man was what it should have been as far as God's concerned. And Boston would have known that. He and his wife suffer just humiliating, debilitating sicknesses throughout their lives and ended up bearing 6 of their 10 children. He knows what he's talking about. He's not just some guy in an easy chair making platitudes. And he goes on to say, in that train or course of events, some things fall out cross to us and against the grain, and these make the crook in our lot. While we are here, there will be cross events as well as agreeable ones in our lot and condition. Some things are softly and agreeably gliding on, but by and by there is some incident that alters that course, grates us and pains us, as when we have made a wrong step, we begin to halt. And he goes on like this for over 100 pages, just reflecting on God's providence and the peculiarities of people's lives. Here are his propositions. Number one, whatever crook there is in one's lot is of God's making. Number two, what God sees fit to mar in our lot, we shall not be able to mend. Number three, considering the crook in the lot as the work of God is the proper means to bring one to behave rightly under it. Consider the work of God. This is not an accident. This is not fate. You may have had some role in it, but overall we see the superintendence of God. And number four, there's a due time wherein those who now humble themselves under the mighty hand of God will certainly be lifted up. There's the hope, the end toward which all these things are contributing. And probably the richest part of all of this is where he's talking about making use of this and what it means to consider the work of God. And it's an extended treatise on how to nurture humility in your heart, of taking your place under the sovereign rule of God. That would be the ultimate bit of counsel in hard times: bow before providence.